tomorrow.
Suit up.
Mission Impossible Fallout is 95% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. It's one of the best action movies ever made.
Showtime.
Rolling Stone calls it off the charts spectacular.
What is he doing?
I find it best not to look.
A thrillingly clever story filled with twists and turns.
Target Ethan Hunt.
We should be dead.
Why aren't we?
With an ending that will blow you away.
Winner out.
In.
Tom Cruise. Mission Impossible Fallout. Tomorrow. Rated PG-13. May be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hello, welcome to the 18th episode of the Hope Illuminated Podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention, mental health promotion, and resilience, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so glad you are here. Boy, are we in for a treat today. I have a very esteemed, internationally renowned researcher, Dr. Thomas Nieden-Krokenthaler, calling in from Vienna, Austria. So just hang tight. You'll hear from him in just a second. We are having a very important conversation today about public messaging, all right? So there's all kinds of ways that we communicate about suicide and suicide prevention, and a very important way that we communicate it about it is what are the narratives, what are the stories that we tell in the public, in the media, in our communities, in our faith communities, in our schools and workplaces. And Thomas is internationally renowned for his research on something called the Papageno effect. And I'm going to have him explain all of that in just a moment. But this is really important because overall, most of our messaging for suicide and suicide prevention isn't great. It's pretty negative. It's pretty hopeless. And this is adding to our problem of not being able to be effective in our prevention. So there's a bunch of us that are really trying to put forth this positive framework, this positive frame on suicide prevention messaging to counteract what I call pounding the drum of the death data, you know, so often. And I understand why it happens, and believe me, I'm guilty of it. It's, you know, you look at the data sometimes around around death and around attempts, and you want to create a sense of urgency around it, so you share the death data. But when that's the only thing that we do, we actually start to create a self-fulfilling prophecy of hopelessness, that there's nothing we can do, and it's inevitable, and isn't it horrible, and somebody should do something about that. So instead of that, we want to promote the positive. And the things I'm going to be sharing with you right now, you can find on a website developed by the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention, suicidepreventionmessaging.org. And basically, the takeaways from what we need to be doing differently is we need to really be giving people positive, specific actions that they can take to help themselves, to help the people they love, and things that they can do in their community and in the society at large that really make a difference. We need to put people to work around this and not let them feel like there's nothing that they can do. Number two, we need to really tell them that prevention works. All right, and I go to always to this to what we can learn from the cancer prevention movement. When we look at how people were thinking about cancer 50, 60 years ago, it was very similar to the place that suicide prevention is right now. People didn't understand it. It was mysterious and daunting, and it felt hopeless, and maybe there was some moral failing involved, and we were just kind of stuck in our thinking. And the cancer movement got pushed through that by two things, science and stories. So instead of only promoting the death data around cancer, they started promoting the recovery data. and the science about what treatments worked, and people started becoming more hopeful. And then the narratives started coming out of people who had survived cancer, and we started elevating them to the status of our cultural heroes. And that has changed everything within the cancer movement. So we can totally take a book, a page from their playbook, and do the same thing for suicide prevention. We need to be promoting the stories of resilience and recovery, not as some pie-in-the-sky idea, but things that are happening right now, to let people see themselves in these stories and realize that they can be transformative, not just for themselves, but others around them by sharing these inspirational stories. We can also share what's working out there, what's working for treatment, what's working for programs and services, that help is available and accessible, and that people can take advantage of that support. So, in essence, we need to change the narratives. We need to change them to hope and connectedness and social support, to demystify what treatment's all about and show what recovery looks like, and even the fact that many people come through periods of suicide intensity or even suicide grief transformed in some way, that even post-traumatic growth is possible for some people. Now, through this, it's not that we want to minimize the pain. That's not the point. But what we want to kind of like more like the hero's journey. We want to understand that through the pain, we have other positive things that are happening, and that pain and death is not inevitable. So I have always found that this work in this positive messaging is empowering, it's inspiring, and actually it's even fun. I think about some of the very creative ways that people have focused on positive messaging, and it's fully engaging. And so my final point, because this is so important to me, is that for those of you who are interested in public messaging through the media, to your legislators, whoever it is that you're talking about this, be mindful that the things as seemingly innocuous as images, right? What are the images we put with our messages? So often we see these images of people looking sad with their head in their hands. We call them the head clutcher pictures. That does not inspire hope. But what does model what we're trying to communicate is people reaching out to one another, people talking in a very compassionate and empathetic way. Those kinds of images are more along the lines of what I'm talking about. Another thing is, you know, what kind of hashtags are we using in social media? There was this whole movement not too long ago about the 22 push-up challenge with the veterans and military, and it went viral and it went international. But what that was doing was actually pounding the drum of death data, that 22 was reflective of the, you know, what they estimated was that, you know, 20 or 22 veterans or military dying each day by suicide. And again, I get it. I understand why it came. It was about the urgency of this is unacceptable. But that kind of message does not inspire hope and, in fact, may even contribute to a narrative of this is what happens. And it's, so instead, I like the hashtags that are coming around World Suicide Prevention Day and National Suicide Prevention Week in the States. And one of them comes from our National Suicide Prevention Lifeline and Dr. John Draper's shop, and it's hashtag Be The One To. It's a positive, action-oriented message. Be the one. Be the one to reach out. Be the one to know your resources. Be the one to follow up. Great stuff. And then lastly, let's be mindful of the instead of telling stories about stigma and broken systems, let's talk about what's working. Let's talk about the research that shows that we can have a different kind of outcome. And let's share stories of hope and recovery and healing and compassion and transformation. And that is going to make all the difference. So it's now my pleasure to introduce our esteemed guest, again calling in from Vienna, Austria. Thomas Niedenkrokenthaler is an associate professor of public health at the Medical University Vienna. He has long-standing experience researching media effects on suicidality and suicidal behavior, and he was the first one to identify and coin the term Papageno effect. I love it, and he's going to explain what it means. This describes suicide protective potentials of stories and personal experience with mastering their suicide crises. Thomas not only holds an MD, but also a PhD in mental health from the Medical University of Vienna and a master's degree in suicide prevention. So he's pretty smart and very accomplished. He received training as Epidemic Intelligence Service Officer at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. Besides research on media effects, Thomas also researches opportunities for social integration after suicidal behavior, so important. And he also evaluates suicide prevention measures. He has authored or co-authored over 70 peer-reviewed publications and co-edited 2 books on suicide and suicide prevention. He's currently a board member of the International Association for Suicide Prevention. That's where I met him, and he's also on the board of the German Association for Suicide Prevention. I love listening to Thomas. Not only does he have a beautiful way of speaking, as you'll get to enjoy in just a moment, but he also is positioning this as positive. What can we do? How can we change the narrative? And his work is so inspiring. So with that, let me turn it over to Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hello, Sally. Good to see you, and thank you so much for being on this show. It's a big honor and a pleasure to be with you today and to speak about this really important topic. And actually, Sally, you said so much important things, so I see that my primary role today is really to emphasize and to provide some details about what you said.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, I think there's a lot to talk about here, and it is a paradigm shift for most people who only hear the negative, who only hear, it only pops into their world when there's a celebrity suicide or when the really daunting negative numbers come out. And so your work is so important, not just for our small, even internationally small suicide prevention community, but the community at large to really start to think of this in a different way. So let's start a little bit, as I always do with my guests, about you and kind of what brought you to this place. What are the things that have led you to be this internationally renowned researcher on suicide prevention? What were some of the turning points for you?
Okay, thank you, Sally. Questions like these, they are really not so easy to answer because it's really hard to tell what really makes something happen, what is the exact reason for someone doing what he or she is doing. Well, I have been thinking about it, obviously, before our call, and I have a few answers, but still I don't know how much impact those answers really had on the developments. But one really important thing is that it's a combination of several things. It's probably some part of it is the personal life history, personality. Something else is opportunities that you can get during your lifespan. And others are certainly rooted in the work itself. So let's start with the personal things. So I can definitely say that I have always been interested in things that are not so much in the mainstream. So even as a child, I was really interested in why do some people do quite well when they are in a very difficult life situations? Why do others really sink into a hole and have so many difficulties to get out of the hole again? So that was a question I remember that puzzled me already as a child, and I was haunting my relatives. They told me with surveys, asking them questions about different stigmatized issues like mental health, and I guess they didn't give me all the correct answers, but it just shows that I've always been interested in things that are stigmatized, in things that are a bit off mainstream, but still things that are extremely important, because it was really a big question to me, why do people consistently talk about things like fashion or what to buy in a shop, and there's absolutely no objection against it, but why do people not speak about death or suicide or self-harm? So that's something that really puzzled me early on already in my life, and because actually everyone experiences that kind of ugly thing that is called death, but nobody is speaking about it. And I certainly had a few. I'm really grateful for the experiences I had with working with my own stigmatized things inside me, because I had obviously the privilege to have some positive experiences with it, which means I made the experience that having a family conflict, it is possible to speak about it. It is possible to make it better when speaking about it. I also experienced losing a close friend to suicide. That was already during my medical studies, and that really struck me extremely hard. It was like a stone to my head. So we had lost connection in the year before his suicide, but he, at some point, he gave me a call and he said, you know, thanks for everything, but he was actually doing better again. But you know, I if that happens again, I think I can't go through that again. And I was extremely busy at the time. I was still during my medical studies, and I made a mistake. I thought it was a mistake. I said, well, probably maybe it won't happen again. And a few weeks later, he died. And that really struck me extremely hard. And at that time, I really experienced the stigma surrounding suicide myself, because it was just really hard to build the community to reflect about that death, to reflect about the loss. And I managed to find people who I could share those experiences with, and that was so important. And at the very same time, I got an opportunity, and that was really a coincidence. So I met my later mentor, Gernot Sonnek, here at the University of Vienna, and he was doing those really interesting and groundbreaking studies, which are really known all over the globe, like the Papageno effect. So he did the studies about suicide on the Viennese subway system. So at that time, that was, I mean, you know, we know a lot about the so-called Werther effect. I don't know if everyone listening to this podcast knows about that.
Yeah,
so maybe
go ahead and take a moment to explain it, and then...
Yes, so it actually means, yes, sure. So what the Werther effect actually means is that after sensationalist reports about suicide, for example, celebrity suicides in newspapers or on TV in different media outlets, it can happen that there is an increase in suicides. And that goes back to a novel by Goethe, The Sorrows of the Young Werther, which was published in around 1770. And that novel is about a guy called Werther, and he loses his love, Lotte, and he then dies by suicide. And there are some historic reports that there were a few young men with the book near the suicide site, and who also had the same motives and died by the same suicide method. And the U.S. sociologist David Phillips took up that term in the 1970s, and because he found that after reports on the title page of the New York Times, there was really an increase in suicide rates, a short-term increase in suicides. And he coined that the so-called Werther effect. And now, there has been a lot of research on that, and there are more than 130 or 40 studies on the Werther effect. So that's really a large amount of studies from different parts of the world. But what was really unclear for a very long time, and that's what I wanted to speak about when I met my mentor, Gernot Sonnek, what was unclear at that point was if you can actually do something to prevent those effects.
Right.
And
right. So I just want to actually highlight a couple of things. So first of all, I'm sorry to hear the loss of your friend. And I think one of the things that, you know, we don't talk enough about is friend loss. You know, I think a lot of our conversation is often around family loss, you know, parents, children, siblings, but we don't really recognize the impact, especially on a young person. Was this a classmate of yours in medical school?
No, it was not a classmate.
Okay.
Was actually my. It was really a friend, and the problem was that I was not connected to his other friends.
Mm.
So I really had to try hard to get in contact with others. That was not easy, and I'm sure that a large part of that was the stigma, was related to the stigma of speaking about it.
And then I just have this beautiful image of you as a child or a teen or a young person running around surveying your relatives. I think that really speaks to, you know, the curiosity of the researcher's mind and that, you know, just haunted by these questions that you need to investigate. And that's just a beautiful picture. And then the power of mentorship, I think, is also something that is really important, not just in our field, but everywhere, that there's a caring adult who is lifting you up, or someone who's had some more experiences that, you know, that lifts you up and has no other agenda, but what can I do for you? How can I help make your pathway a little bit easier? What inspires you today? What fuels your passion? What gets you up every morning to say, you know, diving into the many things that you're doing?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that, actually. So I really enjoy my work, and I enjoy it from the first minute, because that research my mentor originally did, it actually showed that you can prevent those kind of Werther effects. It was about the Viennese subway suicides, the suicides happening on the subway system, and they produced actually in the 1980s already the very first set of media recommendations for reporting on suicide. And at that time, that was all based on expert opinions. So the recommendations said, for example, there's a risk of having more suicides if you report the details about the suicide method. On the other hand, there's a good chance that you can prevent additional suicides if you're reporting about help services, services to people who might be suicidal when they read your media report, so things like that. And there was really a decline of subway suicides by 80%. So that was really
wow.
A big, big finding. And that, when I read that, I really became interested in that immediately. And it also showed on an international level that it is actually possible to change the conversation, to consider more preventive reporting, because one of the very first of my studies showed that the reporting style really improved. So a lot of there was a surprising much interest from journalists. They were really interested in that, and many of them said they just didn't know at the time that the work could actually have such a huge impact. But what was still unclear at this point, and that's where the Papageno effect comes in, what was really unclear at that point was if there was also some other kind of reporting which would not only prevent so-called imitative suicides, but which might even reduce suicides, so which might per se have a preventive impact. And that's where the Papageno effect comes in, because in 2009, I actually did that large study where I wanted to analyze what type of content actually is associated with the increases in suicides after reporting the Werther effect. And I did a huge analysis about hundreds of media reports, all of them published over half a year here in my country, in Austria. And I did a very careful investigation of the content of those articles, and then I did a statistical test to see which content is related to increases in suicides and which is not related to increases. And there was one really striking finding here, and that was one class of media reports. It was a really distinct class of reports. It did not show an increase in suicide. It showed a decrease in suicides. And that was the class of articles which was about mastery of crisis, about individuals telling their stories, sharing their stories, telling how they were able to get help, how they have managed their lives in spite of adverse circumstances, what they have done. So that was a really distinct class of reports, about 6% of reports. It was a small minority, but they really had that promising potential. And Sally, I don't know if you are interested in that detail, but I remember still when I sat together with my colleagues and we were discussing that finding, and we thought, well, that is really extremely important. I mean, there had been some speculations about some media reports being protective at that point already, but there really hadn't been any research on that. And so we were thinking, well, how could we label that? How could we call that, actually? And that's the Werther effect, you know, the Werther effect. We need something that is that's actually a good opposite to the Werther effect. And there was already some research in Austria, in my country, very long time ago about suicide in the opera. And you know that I don't think that the operas are well known in the United States. But if there is one opera known, then it's the Magic Flute from Mozart. And and there are not many people who know that the main protagonist in this opera, that's Papageno, he gets suicidal. He really becomes suicidal because he fears the loss of his love, Papagena, and he really is very desperate, and he prepares everything for his suicide, and he's standing there and counting very slowly to 3, 1, 2, 2.5, and obviously waiting for something to happen in order for him not to have to die by suicide. And in the very last second, the three young boys jump on the stage and say, "Hey, Papageno, don't do it. Don't forget, you just have one life." And they remind him of what else he can do instead of dying by suicide. And that was what we actually thought was the best thing a media report could do. It could remind people who are in a severe, in a difficult situation of what else they can do instead of dying by suicide. And that's how we arrived at the term Papageno effect.
Wow, I love that story. It's absolutely magical. And when I hear, like, it was just a 6% of the group, but they had this finding and you dove into that, it's so important. And this is why we do research, right? And it really fits with some other research, you know, that we're aware of on what reduces stigma. I always love to tell this story that, you know, after my brother died, I was involved in some nonprofit work in Colorado, and we raised just enough money to bring Dr. K. Redfield Jameson into our university. And I had read her work when my brother was quite ill, and I just found her, all of her books, so inspiring. And so when I went to pick her up at the airport, it was like meeting Bono. I was like, oh, Dr. K. Redfield Jameson. And I just started this nonprofit, and I had printed out 1,500 business cards, you know, with our tagline, removing the stigma of mental illness. And so when she got in my car, I said, "Dr. Jameson, what do we do to remove the stigma of mental illness?" And she went, "Oh, dear." And I went, "Oh, no." And she said, "Please stop using that word. Please stop just talking about stigma. It's not how we don't get rid of stigma by talking about stigma." And I went, "Oh, no, 1,500 business cards. What are they going to do?" And then I knew immediately that she was right. And I discovered the work of Dr. Patrick Corrigan, who basically said, you know, education and awareness is not enough to change stigma. What we really need is what he calls, you know, the contact effect, where you're actually hearing the stories and being with the person with whatever marginalized condition it is. It works for all kinds of things that people hide, and that it is the power of their stories, the redemptive and transformative aspects of their stories, that we see the humanity in one another. And we see the hope, and that has now become a big calling of the work that I do, because I think, you know, because people have shame often, or maybe they don't feel like they have permission, the stories of all this resilience and growth and recovery and healing and trials and tribulations and perseverance, they just don't get told. And so nobody knows that they exist. And so I love to have your science behind the things that I'm trying to fan the flames on, because you give me legitimacy to say these stories matter. These stories matter, and we need you. We need these storytellers to change the paradigm. So continue. So please tell us a little bit more about, you know, about your research and some specifics within this finding about what we know about what works.
Right. So really, Sally, I could not agree more. It does make so much sense. It's so important to have a narrative of hope and recovery. And it's not about talking about the stigma, It's really about giving some positive examples that show how to deal with suicidal ideation, with suicide attempt, with loss due to suicide. And actually, our main finding in 2010, it was really a coincidence. It was a coincidence that we identified the distinct group of articles, and it was really the start of our main hypothesis in my research group, which we have worked with in the last 7 years, which is that stories of hope and recovery can have a protective impact on individuals. Now, from the research perspective, it's always difficult to say if the effect you find, if the association you find is a real effect or if it's something else. That is because mm-hmm. if we measure the suicides before a report and we measure the suicides after a report and we compare them and we see there's a decrease, well, we don't know if those people who did not die by suicide, if they actually read the report. We don't know that. And that's why we need many more studies. And that's what we did in recently in the last few years. So we did a few so-called randomized controlled trials where we really measured how people respond to reading a story, to going to a website and watching someone telling his story, telling her story about suicidality and recovery and coping with it, watching even a fictional film where someone is coping with his suicidal ideation. And we really have been looking into how do people react, what does it mean in terms of their suicidality, in terms of their help seeking, in terms of stigma. And we have consistently found that there has been some impact on suicidal ideation. So that is a beneficial impact. And it's a small impact, but still it's a very, very important impact within. Because, as you know, Sally, there's, and you mentioned that right at the beginning, there's so much messaging out there, and a lot of it is negative, but it is already out there. So that study does not only show that it has a potentially protective impact, it shows that there is no risk of communicating about ways how to cope with suicidality. There really doesn't seem to be a risk in that specific way of doing the messaging. So it's really important also for public health and for mental health organizations to balance the risks and opportunities involved in the messaging, which is already out there. So that's a big step forward. And right now we are conducting different studies. We are doing it in different populations because, you know, it's not about one size fits everyone. It's just not like that. It's definitely not in our area, and it's not in other areas as well. So we are
Let me just ask you a quick question about your finding first, which is you said you saw a small impact on it reducing intensity of suicidal thoughts or suicidal ideation. But you also mentioned, were you also measuring changes in help seeking or help giving? Did you measure either of those, and did those change, or were those affected?
What we really found is it was not really the attitudes to help seeking, professional help seeking that changed, but it was really the beliefs that the coping, the so-called coping beliefs that changed. So that we have done several studies in different samples, and it was the same picture across all of those studies. It was always the coping beliefs that changed. So obviously, from those stories, people got some strength because they felt that if they would get even worse, or if they were in the same situation as the people in the story, they would be able to know what to do. So that was really a clear effect in that coping belief subscales. That's probably one of the main explanations. And the other thing is that we have the greatest impact in the whole area of media effects research when people identify with the featured character.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to have different people telling those different stories because not everybody is the same and not everybody identifies with the same person. So it's really important that we have some diversity and people telling their stories and sharing their stories. And there are actually so many initiatives out there which do exactly that, having different people giving their own story of recovery and hope. And that's really important because it's not a one-size-fits-all strategy that would work.
So let me pause you there because this is something that is central to the mission of my new nonprofit, which is United Suicide Survivors International, where we help people, first of all, discern, am I ready? Is this the time for me to share my story? What does it mean if I go public with this? What does it mean for my future, future people in my life, like future partners or children? What does it mean for future employment and other kinds of things? What does it mean to the people in my story? And if we can work through all of that and find a place where people are like, yes, I'm ready, let's do this, then we help them develop the, you know, kind of a hero's journey narrative about, you know, what they went through and how they've come to make meaning about it. And that all that work has really led me to the field of narrative psychology, and I didn't know if that was intersecting in any way with your work, but the idea that telling one's story isn't just good for the listeners, it's also good for the storyteller, and your main piece of work is about it's also good for shifting culture. So I'm just wondering if you had dabbled at all into the other aspects of storytelling and how absolutely powerful it is for personal healing and also interpersonal connection.
Absolutely, Sally. That's so important. It really is not a unidirectional thing. It's not only having an impact on the audience. Now, we did most of our studies in testing the effects on others, on those who are listening to the story, on the audience who's exposed to the story. That's what we did in our research, but I'm getting so many emails and calls from different individuals who tell me about how they experienced their own telling of their stories. And what you are saying, Sally, that's coming up many, many times. So people saying that they felt some relief, they felt more capable to cope by telling their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really evident that it's so much about connectedness. It's not a one size, not even when you tell a story and you have that story on the radio, it's not really a one sided thing. It's really bidirectional. And that's extremely important. And at the same time, of course, it's important to see, am I actually prepared to tell my story? Do I have my story in a way that I want to tell it? And if it's really, if that's the case, then it's really something that can be very powerful also to those who tell their stories, not only to others who listen to the stories. But it's really important also to keep in mind that it's something that will have an impact, that it's important to be aware about the consequences of telling private things in public, and maybe it's good to try the story with some friends or colleagues and ask them how they feel about it, just to be able to know how do I feel with the reactions to my story. Is my story ready to being told? Is it a good point in time to tell my story? But if there is a yes to all of these questions, then I hear from them often experience a great uh, a, a great effect from their own storytelling.
Yeah, it's really amazing to see that process unfold. I mean, it just happened to me yesterday. I'm in Toronto this week, and the reason I'm in Toronto, Canada, is because this week I've been presenting to a group of union construction workers, which is my absolute sweet spot. I love speaking to these mostly men, 95-97% men, who are, you know, often living in the perfect storm of suicide risk, and no one has ever given them permission to talk about it through their loss or through their own personal experiences. And so they are just so hungry for this information, and they're hungry to talk about their stories. And just yesterday, one of the guys came up in the break, and he said to me, you know, I'm a attempt survivor, and it was a long time ago, but I know I'm not the only one now. You've told me I'm not the only one. And so if my story can help any of these other guys, can I tell it? Will you help me tell it? And it's just so, it's like the best part of the work for me is to really empower people not to be ashamed, but to really focus on the resilience and watch them get strength from helping others through their experience. It's just awesome. So let's turn back to your research and tell me a little bit more about, you know, kind of what's on the horizon. What are some of the big questions that you're working on now?
Yes. So one thing, we are right now looking at different populations. So we're having a project in LGBTIQ individuals. We're looking into which stories could help them when they feel suicidal, for example, because during their coming out phase. We have one project in adolescents who suffer from different kinds of mental illnesses, and we see which stories might work for them. We have another one for adults. So there are a lot of trials right now going on, looking into the specific question, which stories work for whom. So that's really the main question, and that's so important. And we get a lot of interesting things also from studies from other fields. So what you, Sally, said just a few minutes ago, in fact, that Papageno effect, it's not really, it's new to our field. It's new mm-hmm. to our field. And I remember 15 years ago when I started, or six, now it's 17 years ago when I started in the field, there was really a very negative negative attitudes toward the impact of media within the suicide prevention, suicide research community. So it was not it was really like there were only negative impacts. So that has changed a lot. But in fact, it's not new that media can do good for mental health. There's so much self-help literature out there, which is always about narratives of how to cope in some way, not only suicidal ideation, also a difficult life situations, mental illness, etc. So there's a lot out there. It's not coming out of the nothing, the Papageno effect. And there are also studies from totally different fields, which I feel are extremely important and are very worthwhile to look into for our field, for the field of suicide prevention. And one area that has captured my interest is the area of normative messages. So that's the work of Robert Cialdini and colleagues from Arizona State University. What they did actually, and I think that's really relevant to our messaging field, what they did, they looked into how different norms, as they are communicated, impact on the behavior of individuals. And what they, for example, did is they went to an amusement park somewhere in the U.S. and there was one situation where they put up a shield that said, "Don't litter the environment here." And the environment was not littered. And then they had another situation where they put on the same shield, and that in a littered environment. And then they looked at what people who passed by would do. And what they found was really very interesting. So if the shield was put up in an unlittered environment, people did not litter it much. If they put it up in an environment which was a little bit, only a little bit littered, so some other people obviously littered that, there was even less littering. And if they put it up in an environment which was littered, basically everyone was littering there, the environment, every mm-hmm. participant. So what does that actually tell us in the suicide prevention field? It tells us there are different kinds of norms. And Cialdini calls that the so-called descriptive norms. Descriptive norms means what people actually do. If you are walking in an environment that is littered, the descriptive norm is littering is what people do. If you put up a shield saying don't litter the environment, that's a so-called injunctive norm. It means what people should do. So there's the message don't litter the environment, but everyone is littering the environment. And the effect of that obviously was that people were littering more. So what does that mean to our messaging field? And I'm coming back to what you said, Sally. Initially, there's a lot of negative messaging out there as well. And what could happen is that people are saying there are thousands of suicides each year. Don't do it. Yeah?
Exactly.
So you have the message, you have a descriptive norm like dying by suicide is the normal thing to do. Descriptive norm, injunctive norm, do something else. Do something else. Don't
do it.
What kind
of norm? What's the second kind of norm?
The so-called injunctive norm.
Injunctive. Okay.
Right. That's how they called it. And,
so what
we learn from that is that the descriptive and the injunctive norm should align. And that brings me back to the media because, you know, and you said that as well, Sally, in the beginning, media are always interested in the unusual things. So the stories that happen frequently, they do not typically get told. We need to tell them. We need to tell the stories in order for them to get told. But the mass media are often interested in the unusual things, and those are more the suicides that happen. But the most frequent thing that happens is that people manage to cope. People do manage to cope with suicidal ideation. And those stories need to be told because they have both a descriptive norm of how to cope with things and an injunctive norm. You can cope with it too. There is a way. Let's discuss it. There is a way to get over those kinds of problems. So I think there is a lot we can learn from research from our field, but also from other fields when it comes to that messaging. And we are currently doing different projects to see how that really translates to the suicide prevention field.
Excellent. And that, you know, thinking about learning from different fields, I spent a lot of my formative years at a university doing health and wellness and substance abuse prevention kinds of things. And back in the day, in the late 90s, early 2000s, we had this thing called social norms marketing. So the descriptive norms were what people were seeing about alcohol misuse all over campus, the beer bottles and the broken windows and the drunkenness. It was very salient, those behaviors and that evidence was very salient. And those descriptive norms were shaping the expectation that everybody gets drunk all the time. But what we knew from the data was wasn't the case. Most students either weren't drinking or were drinking responsibly, you know, within ranges where they weren't getting drunk most days and the grand majority. But that wasn't what the descriptive norms were telling. And so our efforts back then that I also think play out here was to share the data that, you know what, you know, 75% of our students are either drinking nothing or drinking three or few drinks most days. And that when we started to promote that different social norm that was based in the data of the community, you start to see a shift down, not of the high-risk drinkers, but of the middle-of-the-road drinkers that are drinking to fit in. And I also think one of the shifts that I've seen through this effort is a lot of the recovery community for addictions are really, they've been helped quite a bit by 12-step programs and the importance of anonymity, you know, the importance of this is, you know, my recovery is private. And they find, you know, their small tribe of people, it's not so small, but they find small clusters of their tribe to kind of lean on one another and get support and so forth. And what I'm seeing within that community is I'm at a certain place in my recovery now where I want to tell my story. And I understand why anonymity was important for me in the beginning. But now I don't want to be anonymous anymore. And so I'm starting to see a lot of my colleagues in recovery also coming out with their story of how they lived through their addiction and have become well. So let me just kind of go through let me just ask you, do you have some specific takeaways for our folks that are out there wondering what do they do with all this research? What are some steps that they can take maybe in their communities to message in a more positive way or in a more protective way?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I certainly do. So I have my core message really is that it is so important to speak about suicidality, to speak about how one can manage suicidal ideation, what can be done after a suicide attempt, what can be done after a loss due to suicide, and to do that responsibly. And doing that responsibly means different things. So first, I don't know if there are any journalists or media professionals on listening to the podcast, but I would like to tell them it's so important to write about suicidal ideation, about suicidality, and to do that responsibly, considering the media recommendations for suicide reporting. They are available at, for example, reporting on suicide.org. So that's so important. And sometimes journalists ask me, now you are telling me about the Werther effect and it really seems to be a problem. Do you think I should run the story at all? And then I tell them, if it's really a story about, for example, a celebrity suicide that has been written already several times, then maybe it's better not to report it again if it's again only about the suicide or the suicidal act or something. But at the same time, if they know that if they won't do the report, one of their colleagues will do the report, then it's better for them to do it because they know what the risks are and what the opportunities are, and that it's so important to also list help offers for those who might be adversely affected by the story. But at the same time, the more important thing is also to consider reporting about how to cope with suicidal ideation. And that's not normally happening in the news media. It's more the background stories. So they mm-hmm. so to wait a bit and to provide some background, a story of an individual who managed to cope with suicidal ideation, who went to the crisis intervention center, etc., etc. So those are the stories which really seem to have a powerful impact on others. And then there is a message to mental health experts as well, because, you know, in that 2010 study, the Papageno study, another finding which is also important was that expert statements were often put into a very sensationalist context, so which means that you had a story which was very sensationalist and very much focused on the suicide method, and then you had an expert saying giving a very brief statement, and it sometimes seemed as if the expert statement was used to give some sense of seriousness to the article instead of giving a hopeful statement. So the message to mental health experts would be, it's really important to share what we know about storytelling and to give helpful information to the media and to provide background. But at the same time, it's also, we have had very good experiences with asking journalists if they can share the article with them before publishing it. A lot of journalists are very much interested in doing that. And then it is about what's the context actually of the story. And of course, the third group I'd like to address is those who have personal experience with suicidal ideation, with a suicide attempt or with loss due to suicide, who want to share their story. So it's really there's so much potential in there, and it's so important to do it responsibly for oneself, which means thinking about how you said it, Sally, thinking about what's actually the phase I'm currently in. Am I ready to tell the story? Maybe get in touch with others who have told their stories, ask them what their experiences were, thinking about it, how could I actually shape my story, because there are always different elements in a story, and the elements are also changing if you think about it many times. It's like with any story, with any life experience, it's changing. And once it's ready, then it's a really powerful tool in order to help others who might be in a similar situation.
Oh, fabulous, Thomas. Thank you. That really was very succinct and useful. So let me just go back and do a brief recap of some themes in our conversation today, and then I'll come back to you for some final thoughts. So we started the conversation off with kind of getting a glimpse of some early formative experiences and, you know, what it's like to have the mind of a researcher where these haunting questions kind of compel you to go out and look at what the data are telling us about potential answers and to start to formulate new directions for change. You talked about the Werther effect, and I'll be posting a lot more about all of these effects and the research and also the recommendations on the show notes of the podcast. But the Werther effect was kind of the only thing we knew for a while about, you know, this imitative effect of high-profile or well-publicized suicide deaths, and it was very concerning. And I think all of that research possibly gave journalists some fear about, oh, my gosh, do we report on this? We could potentially be causing harm. And I think many of them kind of shied away from any type of reporting related to suicide. And then here comes Thomas and his mentor and a number of other researchers saying, but wait, that's not the whole story. We also have this small but very important finding of, you know, 6% of reports, a certain type of a distinct class of media reports has a promising potential. Let's dig in deeper there. And you labeled it the Papageno effect, which is very a great way for people to connect to what is actually happening. It ties into some of the other stigma reduction literature out there by Patrick Corrigan and others. And then you kind of took it to the next level by doing some randomized control trials to really understand what types of stories, what types of impact is having on people as they're reading these stories or watching films. How are we shifting their beliefs around coping? How does it shift their identity or connection to the character? And this really just all leads us to the power of storytelling, the power of storytelling to the individual, to the person listening to the story, and to the collective culture and the narratives that we create about coping and connectedness. I'm really excited to see where you're taking your new directions for your research. I think the more we drill down into this and get more specificity about which stories are working for whom, the more powerful our arsenal will be in how we shape this. And we just talked a little bit about the importance of social norms marketing and how we can pull from other fields and already take advantage of some of the research that's happening there. And then your summary takeaways for those who are doing public messaging, our journalists and others who are putting forth messages for public consumption, don't be afraid. Write these stories. Write stories and write them responsibly. If there are high-profile suicides that are, quote-unquote, newsworthy, you know, be the one to tell that story responsibly. Pivot off the sensationalized story as quickly as possible and check out, you know, connect back into stories of coping, resources, and resilience. And see if you find opportunities to make those stories the main story, not just the background. To the mental health experts, you're not just in these stories to add credibility to a sensationalized story. Your story also matters, and your data around what works in treatment is so critical to the conversation. And then finally, for people with lived experience, we need you. We need you. But we also need you to do this in a way that's good for you. So take the time. I call it discerning. Take the time to check in with yourself and the small inner voice. This is your story, and you have ownership over it, and you get to tell it when and how you want to tell it. So take that time to do it in a way that feels best for you. Thomas, any last thoughts from you?
Oh, thank you so much, Sally, for this great summary. I would like to really invite everybody to join in for the September 10th, that is World Suicide Prevention
yes.
Day. And in
yes.
2018, our motto will be working together to prevent suicide. And I think, Sally, that fits so well with your podcast and with what we have discussed, because only when we collaborate, when we work together, then we can really effectively prevent suicide. And that obviously also applies to messaging. So I invite everybody to join us on World Suicide Prevention Day. There are different initiatives like cycling around the globe, which is about cycling together or alone, slowly or quickly, in order to raise awareness about suicide and suicide prevention. There's another initiative, Light a Candle, which is about lighting a candle at around 8 p.m. on September the 10th in order to think about people we have lost to suicide and people who are in crisis and suicidal. So join us for World Suicide Prevention Day.
So important. And I will also put that on the show notes. Thank you. So this was fabulous, Thomas. I always love when we can pull together, you know, the stories, the science, and the strategy for suicide prevention. And you have done that so beautifully over the last hour. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about your work and connect to you?
They can certainly drop me an email. You know, my name is very difficult to pronounce and spell. But I think it's on your website. They can drop me an email, and there is a, there is some information out there. It's suicidforschung.at. The name is in German, but the website is in English. So it's probably best to drop me an email and get in touch directly. And you have the email, Sally.
Well, thank you for being generous with your email. I will put it in the show notes because you're right. Your name is very long and hard to spell, so we won't try to do this auditorially. So wonderful. So that's a wrap. And if you enjoyed this episode as much as I have, I really encourage you to subscribe to the podcast. You can find the podcast on iTunes. Please go ahead and subscribe, leave a rating and review. That helps people find us. You can get all the show notes on my website, sallyspencerthomas.com, and we're also airing through Blog Talk Radio. And so please sign up for my newsletter. You can hear more about the upcoming podcasts, the webinars that we're doing through United Suicide Survivors International, our monthly Twitter chats, blogs. We've got a whole bunch of things going on over there. So please join us. We need you in this army to prevent suicide. So in closing, open your heart, challenge your thinking, and take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living.
This is New York firefighter Raphael Poirier. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase. This is New York firefighter Raphael Poirier. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase.